accession number 27060, reel 9.
This is the fifth reel of a taped interview with Bill Stacey in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 25th of 5th, 2004, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Bill, we've obviously been talking about your period in North Africa, Greece, Crete. You managed to get back to Egypt. What were you to do at that point? And let's talk then about coming home.
Well, when we were evacuated from Crete, we were serviced by the 2nd 9th Field Regiment, and we only spent 2 or 3 days back at our old camp in Egypt. And then we were entrained and bused to a camp in Palestine called Kassa, which we spent being re-equipped and trained, and we received quite a big number of reinforcements, and training went on endlessly was the word for it, because there was no let up at all. And then finally the decision was made to send us back to Australia, and we departed by buses to I think the name of the place is El Kantara, where the section of the unit that I was boarded, the Durban Castle, which we'd used before on our way to coming back from England, and we had a pretty trouble-free journey from there through the Suez Canal and down to, and we docked in Adelaide, in Port Adelaide.
Can we talk about the trip home? And you were one of the lucky ones to get off Crete.
Yeah.
How were you feeling at that time?
Well, actually, we were starting to become very bored, because quite a long time had elapsed since the regiment had been in action, and now that was coming up to strength again, we felt that we should be used. But when we found out that the Japanese were starting to make progress in the Pacific, we thought that we should be back in Australia. We really thought that, and we were quite pleased when the authorities decided to send the Australian troops, less than 9th Division, back to Australia. The journey on the Durban Castle was quite uneventful, although routine exercises and lectures were continuous, so that nobody had much spare time to themselves. But when we got back to Adelaide, we were sent to a place called Stirling, just north of Adelaide, where we were encamped in first and only ever time in Australian Army history where the regiment was marched up the road with the CO in the lead, with some housing officers, they were called, billeting officers, and they went into houses and asked how many people lived in the house and how many people occupied the house, and if they said they had 4 bedrooms and 2 people, there's 4 soldiers allotted to each house, which was, of course, in most cases, people thought it was wonderful. Anyhow, we're all billeted, and that was the first and only time in Australia that a soldier's, although the army apparently always had that authority, it was the first time it was ever used.
In relation to returning home, were you to stop off anywhere along the way?
No, we had a direct... we pulled into what is would be called now Saudi Arabia, but... just for a day to reassemble the rest of the... When we come out of the canal, we pulled into one of the Arab Emirates there, mm-hmm. while the convoy assembled. And when it assembled, then we took off, and it was as far as I can remember, without incident all the way to Adelaide.
The average day on board, you mentioned some of the duties that you were involved with, but what of, you mentioned lectures, did you experience at any time on board ship concert parties, for instance?
No, not at that time. We didn't have any concert parties at all. You know, it's just... although the unit itself did have, before we came out of Crete, they had a very, very good concert party in the unit itself. But that of most of those people were captured in Crete, so that busted up. It was never ever reformed again.
So then, when you weren't on duty, when you weren't training, when you weren't listening to lectures, what did the average soldier get up to on board ship?
Mostly played cards, write letters, just talk about the events of previous events and what maybe was going to happen when we got to Australia. We were unsure of what our duties were going to be and where we'd go. And it was all speculation. Nobody really knew anything, you know. And they were a bit concerned about the Yanks being in the major eastern cities and we weren't there, sort of thing.
Why?
Well, I suppose it was because we thought they might be messing around with all the birds.
How were the Americans seen? You mentioned, obviously, the attitude that some of the soldiers had, but how had they been seen since their involvement?
Well, I thought that they were all right as far as I was concerned, but a lot of people thought that they'd, with the typical American forwardness, you know, they were in the war, so it was all right, they were going to win it, and their command sent a letter out to all personnel that said that, in a few words, said to them, just watch what you're doing with these Australians, because some of them have been in the war for 4 years, and if you give it too much cheek, you're liable to get into a lot of trouble. That's exactly what they, you know, what the letter intimated, but I personally never had any trouble with them at all, but... there were quite a few brushes, especially in the Townsville area, where there was a very big mixture of Yanks and Australians, and the competition for the pubs that were open at the time used to cause considerable friction.
What was it like to be heading back to Australia?
Well, in a way it was great, and in another way it was, we sort of moving away from where the main theatre of war was, that we were a bit disappointed in that. But if we'd have known what was going to happen when we came back to Australia, the way we were broken up and the units of the division attached to militia units to strengthen them or retrain them or whatever it was, but it was very disappointing for a division that had done so well in the Middle East, and we spent many, many boring months in northern Queensland just twiddling our fingers, actually, because routine orders were syllabus as provided every morning, and it just went on and on and on and on, and morale started to get a bit low with the what for, what are we doing this for, why aren't we in action, because I think everybody thought that was their prime reason for being in the army, was to fight.
What had you heard of the Japanese and how they'd been going?
Well, we'd heard a bit about the Japanese and their ruthlessness, and that they were entirely different ethically to what we were.
What sort of things have you heard?
We heard about their campaign in the Asian countries, where they unwantedly killed people that had no connection with the fighting at all, massacres, and no corner for prisoners. Generally doing things that soldiers don't normally do. We're not supposed to do anyway.
Well, how did that make you feel?
Well, but I think it jazzed things up a little bit. People were a bit keen to get at them, you know. Well, they knew that they had a cause, the cause that they were fighting for was vindicated by the fact that these people were considered to be more animal than they were human being, and that's actually what we thought about them, you know. And later on, when we got to New Guinea, it was a proven fact. When we made contact ourselves, it was a proven fact that that's what they were. I think the worst part of my unit's 6 years in the, as a unit was the delays in northern Queensland, where we sat in our bums and twiddled our fingers and done things just for sake of doing things. And it wasn't until towards the time that we left for New Guinea that we really started to train properly, you know. We then started to do amphibious work and all that sort of thing, which incidentally the only time we used it was when we got off the boat onto barges to go into Wee-Wak. But that was the most boring and time of the whole of the history of the unit was in that northern Queensland. And
can we just talk briefly about your experiences at the home front? Presumably you went on leave on the odd occasion.
No, I only had, in all the time I spent in Australia, I only had one lot of 14 days leave.
And what did you do in that time?
Well, I got married. In that time,
Tell us about that.
Well, I've sort of been going with the one girl since I was about 15, and she was 14, I think she was, and we stuck together all the way, and when I was in the militia, she used to come up and visit me on the weekends when I was in camp, and then we were very much in love, and then I went overseas, and she stuck with me. And then I came back from the Middle East, and I got some for leave from Queensland. Actually, we didn't even get leave when we arrived in Adelaide. We stayed there a few weeks, and then we were in train straight through to Townsville, and so consequently, when I was up in Townsville for about 8 or 10 months, I'd become eligible for leave, and I went, and it was all pre-arranged. I went down, and we were married. I got there one on the Friday, I think. We were married on the Saturday, went on a short honeymoon to Tuggera Lakes for a week, and came back.
And was that a thing that people were concerned about, getting married during wartime?
No, I don't know. Seemed to be a lot of fellows in my unit were married on their leaves, you know, the girls that they knew before they it was mostly that way, I think, girls that they'd been going with. Of course, most of the fellows were older than I was, you know. I was 21 when I got married, so we'd been together like we were engaged for most of that time. We went together before the war, I suppose, for a year or so, and my wife was 19 when we were married. And of course, in those days, it wasn't thought fit to be sleeping with people before you were tied the knot, and it was a big event. Anyhow, she stuck with me, and I went away again and went to New Guinea and come back.
Was there any concern that getting married during that time?
Well, I think there was, you know, yeah, that's right. That a lot of people didn't get married at that time. That's why there were so many people married immediately after the war. I think that the pressure of the thought of the person being away and maybe getting killed, and maybe in that period the children had arrived or something like that. But my kids were born after the war was over, my two children, and here we are. We're both 83 and 81, and we're still together. But as I said before, our worst period in the unit's history was that time spent in northern Queensland, where we were broken up as a division, and And the greatest thing that ever happened was when the information came that we were to reform as a division, and we come back, and the enthusiasm started all over again. Really, the training became more intense, and we were with our own brigades and ready to go again, you know, which they proved when they got to New Guinea, you know, that they were still the best fighting force in the Australian Army, and I say that unequivocally. Of course, it could be a bit biased.
You were talking about the knowledge of the Japanese, and to what degree had you understood their attack plan, what they had been involved with? Had you understood about Kokoda, for instance?
Well, we started thinking about this even before Kokoda, you know, and some of us were of the opinion that, righto, people are talking of them as supermen and everything, but who have they ever beat? You know, that was our attitude. They've never run into anybody. And then, of course, what didn't help with the Japanese myth was the bloody Singapore debunkle. You know, that should never have happened. They should have been stopped right there. And if that had been done properly, they would have been stopped right there. But it was a complete and utter balls up, and they'd give them a reputation of being supermen. I tell you what, when they run into some decent opposition, they weren't supermen, although don't get me wrong, I'm not saying they're gutless, they're not. It's bred into them that it's a fight to the finish with them, and they do that too, and they're brave men for that reason. You know, I remember in New Guinea, they got this fella in, and we had a doctor and another officer prisoner, and they wouldn't talk, they wouldn't do anything, just sat there in silence. So this interpreter fella that was doing, intelligence fella that was doing the interrogating, there was a black fuzzy was he going past, so he hooked this black fuzzy and he sat him down between the doctor and the loot, and I tell you what, he's only there 3 minutes, and the doctor started to talk, and they moved the doctor out, and the doctor spilt the whole beans. He was so insulted to have this fuzzy wuzzy sit beside him, you know, because he was kamikaze man, you know, the sword and the other loot. He was horrified to have this person defiling his presence. And
obviously they had the loyalty to the emperor, which made them fanatic in many
ways. They were fanatics, you know, and they had, and I don't care what anybody says, fanaticism's one thing, but they had an underlying fear. They knew very well that if they didn't do what they were told or reach an objective, that the consequences to them was almost as bad as the enemy, you know. I remember they were coming in, obviously they'd planted the yams some time before, they knew where the garden was, and they come in and they killed about four or five of them, and then about 4 days later another mob came in, and they decided they killed them, and then some more came in the third time, they hooked into a couple of them, and their reason was simple, that they knew the yams were there, the officers had told them to go and get the yams. Well, you either got the yams, or when you come back without the yams, you got a belt, and so, you know, they just went down there. It was a no-win situation, and yet they done it. Well, you know, when you're fighting people like that, I still say that initially they're brave people, only through the way that they live and they're taught. Yeah. But they're certainly no supermen.
Was there a sort of feeling in the air at home of the closeness that Japan had come to Australia?
Oh, yeah, I reckon that, especially when they started talking about, what did they call it, drawing that line, that they'd defend back to that. A lot of people, us fellas in the army, we didn't take to that too very well, because our idea was to fight them on somebody else's soil, not on our own, you know. And maybe if it hadn't been for the Yanks and the Coral Sea, they might have
got down there too. Well,
they got pretty close, all right. But, of course, it was a great thing that they didn't get any closer because everything was wide open. Very wide open.
Have you heard of Darwin?
Yes, it's... things weren't too good up there, apparently, either. As far as our mob was, our soldiers were concerned, if you can believe what we heard at the time, people didn't stay where they were supposed to be, and yet there was no invasion. You know, it was just bombing, which is nothing really. They didn't even find out what was going on.
How did people treat you as a returned soldier, a chap that had seen action?
Oh, well, I thought they thought we were great, you know. We got a lot of... we did really get a lot of respect, especially when the first medal bar that they issued was the Africa Star, and anybody that had the Africa Star ribbon on, they were number one, you know. They were real fighting men, you know. And that's because that was the only medal we had for ages, the Africa Star. So it was a brilliant piece of thought, whoever thought about issuing the ribbon, because it was the one way of distinguishing anybody that had been in an action at that time, you know. Although, of course, in our unit, in our division, we were still are very disappointed that there was no recognition of the Greece and Crete campaign whatsoever, you know.
Well, what had you heard of the situation that had ensued at Crete? Following you getting out, what had you heard of the others that hadn't?
Oh, we didn't get very much information at all until it started to trickle back through letters and that sort of thing, you know, and through prisoner of war camps that some people in the unit got roundabout communications from fellas out of the unit that were in prisoner of war camps, and apparently, of course, we heard all about it in our unofficial histories afterwards, you know, and it couldn't have been too bloody good, apparently, but it was a lot better than what it was in the Japanese camps. We heard a fair bit about that.
What have you heard?
About the way they treated their prisoners and the lack, food situation was just about nil. And of course, one of the things that I was told afterwards is that the Japanese nearly treated their soldiers just the same as everybody else, you know. The officers were terribly cruel people, and they accepted anybody under them was nothing. They didn't do what they were told, but they accepted the consequences.
And some people would say, well, you go to war to win, and you basically do whatever you have to do to win.
Well,
some people say fanaticism, some people say, well, they were good soldiers. They basically went to war to win, knowing that they were basically saying goodbye to their parents on leaving Japan. How was that seen in relation to what you might be prepared to do, for instance, given that you were going off to fight a war too?
Yeah, well, that occurs because there's no redress. Like, their officers are there, and they say, you go and do so-and-so, and if you don't do it, well, you get knocked off anyway. So, you know, the pressure that was put on to do what they were told to do, I don't think that sometimes... the personal bravery doesn't come into it, really.
My impression, the difference, is that if a Japanese soldier goes off to war, he is not expected to come back unless they win.
Yeah, oh, that's right.
With the Germans and Italians, Australians, the European form of war, well, you go away and you have a
stoush,
and whoever wins.
Yeah, that's right.
But the others come home.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, well, yeah, that's right. When you look at it that way, you know, they're not considered heroes. They're considered heroes if they come home after a victory, but if they come home after a defeat, they're almost ignored, you know. The last thing a Japanese apparently ever wanted to be was a prisoner of war. I mean,
well, knowing that some of these things possibly, what did it feel like to know that you were now training to fight the Japanese?
Yeah, well,
this
we knew that when we went into action that it was a no quarter thing, and they had no mercy or sympathy or. And in the conditions that were for in New Guinea that were fighting took place, there's no room for much quarter. I mean, you're so close in all your actions, you're not standing back miles apart, and then gradually you're sitting on one another's doorsteps all the time. And the terrain alone is it's unbelievable. People don't realise that the terrain in, you know, the gullies and the twisted bloody hilltops and the thick jungle, and like you could have somebody 10 yards away and you wouldn't even know they were there. Even the Japanese said that when they asked them who was the best jungle fighters, they said, what about the Americans? They said, oh, they're not jungle fighters, the jungle goes before they go in. What about the Australians? He said, they're the best. He said, because you're walking along the track and all of a sudden there's somebody there with you shooting at you because of their camouflage and, you know, close contact action, as Australians are very good at. And I think they pioneered camouflage, really. Our fellas became extremely good at camouflage.
What then of your training and how you were being prepared to go and fight in the Pacific region now?
Yeah, well, you know, there's parts of Queensland around Cairns and up in the hills through Cairns there that are worse bloody jungle than what there is in New Guinea, and that's where we trained, you know, through that jungle area there. Bloody Waita Wild and bloody Gympie Bush and all that sort of thing. It's all there. It was very, very good training area, actually. Learning how to get guns through that area, and, you know, you can't just take a tractor in there and pull the gun into it. Sometimes it's got to be manhandled into the area where it's got to be, you know. The tractor can only go so far. And then the different methods of firing too. As you know, in those high angle shots of the guns, that was unheard of previous to that. In my opinion, the worst place anybody could ever fight a war is in a jungle area, especially of a night time. You can put your finger an inch from your eyes and you can touch your eyeballs. You're trying to penetrate the absolute blackness, you know, the difference between dark and this is black. You just can't see anything. Put your hand up in front of you, can't see your hand, it's just so dense. And then a booty rat or something will knock a tin over, and everybody stands too. You don't know what it is, you know. The big leaf, or there's always rotten branches falling off trees, and so it's a very nervous area of fighting, actually, of being a soldier under those circumstances. You're always waiting for daylight. And a mate, he's dead now. We used to carry a baby's, but we found this galvanised baby's bath, and we carried it around, and every time we'd take it in turns and we'd get somewhere where we could have a wash, we used to fill her up and have a good old slosh in it, you know. So it was out the front of where we were dug in, and this mate of mine, he goes bang, and the thing jumped up, rolled away, and he goes bang, and he put three shots into it, and everybody stood two. It was about 2 o'clock in the morning, and we stood two until daybreak, and when we woke up, he put three bullets through this baby's bath within an inch of one another. We thought it was great shooting, but we nearly kicked him to death for buggering our bath up, you know. But that's, everything seems to get legs or move of a night time, you know, in those jungle situations. It's, you're tense all the time. It's especially if you're out in the listening post and you, things are moving around. We're a bit lucky in New Guinea. There's not very many big animals, so.